Dear friends, today we have with us Nick Collins, who is a maritime trade expert and a historian, and who's also the author of a very fascinating book, How the Maritime Trade and the Indian Subcontinent Shaped the World. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Pallavi.
Yeah. Nick, I want to begin by asking you about this really fascinating book that you've written, which has implications for how we see world history as it is taught today. And also tell us how you got into this research, because it is a very fascinating field, but a niche field.
Indeed. Well, a little bit of explanation then is needed. I studied history at Cambridge many, many years ago. And then I got my career was in maritime trade, that is in shipping, as a shipbroker. When I retired in 2014, December 2014, I was aware that there was absolutely no book on the history of maritime trade. Now, you've got books on the history you've got specialized books. I don't know, about 50, 60 years ago, there was a spate of books in English about 14th and 15th century Baltic trade. But nobody had ever put the whole thing together and specifically concentrated on trade rather than battles, which are deemed to be more glamorous. So I started writing with no expectation that this was going to lead me to India in such a big way. I'd already discounted the Aryan invasion theory as nonsense, and the Mediterranean Bronze Age chronology, which was wrong by roughly 300 years. But I wasn't prepared to do anything revolutionary other than that. But the more I researched it, the more this concept of the Middle East and Mesopotamia being the cradle of civilization just seemed totally wrong. Indeed, anybody studying the Indus-Saravati civilization must be aware that this was humans groundbreaking civilization in so many ways. And in my particular case, I was interested in the trade between India, Northwest India, and Mesopotamia, with Oman and Bahrain, in ancient terms, Magan and Dilmun, as intermediaries, and providing the Gulf's seafaring merchants and mariners. But it was the Indian merchants and mariners that were predominant. And it just struck me as they were exporting food, timber, wheat, stuff to sustain Mesopotamian civilization. Remember that at about 3000 BC, we'd seen the Sahara, which previously was grassland and savanna, become desert. Something similar probably happened in Mesopotamia, and therefore the center of civilization was along the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. But their economy by 3000 BC was pretty primitive. They got sheep farms. They made woolen cloth, and they exported it. But there didn't seem to me to be much else that they could export to India, which, you know, not only had the food and the corn and the ghee and all that kind of stuff and the timber, but they also had carnelian beads and agate beads and all the stuff that was being produced in the ports and elsewhere. I did a lot of research on the economy of Mesopotamia at the time, and it seems that they had a lot of merchants in southern Anatolia extracting the minerals or buying the minerals for selling the cotton, sorry, selling the woolen cloth. And that must have been something that they've been re-exporting to India. But really, was it enough? Because you know, there's a big imbalance, it seemed to me. But they were also importing gold from Egypt, and as we know, Indians have always loved gold. And if you take a big historical perspective, the Romans paid for gold for all the stuff they imported, drugs, medicines, pearls, ivory, and all that kind of stuff. And Roman emperors were pretty worried about the drain of gold from there. So it seemed not not too silly an idea to say that this was also driving this trade. So at about 3000 BC, the state in Mesopotamia called Uruk, a big state with lots of colonies further north, towards, not including Anatolia, but towards Anatolia, invaded Egypt. At about the same time, in fact, I think simultaneously, Phoenicians took over the Levant coast, Byblos and Tyre. And immediately thereafter, they started trading with Egypt, specifically the cedar of Lebanon, to make the temples in Egypt, and then all kinds of other goodies from Anatolia and around the place. Essentially, the Egyptians hated the sea. It was their god of death was associated with the sea. They relied entirely on the Phoenicians. So joining all the dots together, it seems that this was a coordinated invasion. When you think of it, this is a huge logistical undertaking. An invasion by sea through the Wadis to Egypt and a takeover of the Levant by land, I guess. And a complete change in the culture in Byblos, according to the archaeologists about this time. So, if we then can join the dots and assume that there was this great coordinated invasion by both Phoenicians, who by tradition came from Eden, according to Roman writers and earlier writing Greek writers, they came from Eden, which is widely assumed to be Bahrain, which is the seat of where Gulf traders were and mariners were operating from. It was called Eden because this is where fresh water still rises in springs, very useful in an arid climate. And was one of the stepping stones in trade from Sumeria to India. Now, joining all the dots and making a logical conclusion, I asked, why? Why did they invade Egypt? What was the purpose? And the only reason I can think of that makes any sense at all in historical terms is that they were after the gold. The gold, which would pay India for the increasing number of goods that arid Mesopotamia needed. Now, there is no smoking gun. I'm not saying that, you know, anybody's found any royal correspondence which says, let's invade Egypt for the gold. There is none. It's just a joining of the dots and logic and historical perspective that leads me to this conclusion.
So if we were to briefly conclude your analysis, you're suggesting that the Indians and the Mesopotamians did a lot of trade, and that it's a possibility that the Mesopotamians and the Sumerians they went towards Egypt and invaded Egypt because there was gold there, so that they could then export that gold to India in return for other goods.
To pay for the Indian goods, which was needed to give life to their civilization, really. I mean, the Mesopotamian civilization at Uruk was incredibly sophisticated, but obviously it depended on India, and not as sophisticated as the Indus Sarasvati civilization. And it doesn't have the rich literature of the you know, of Vedic India, but it's still an impressive civilization. So much so that when these cities in Mesopotamia were uncovered in the 19th century, archaeologists said, "Oh, this must be the cradle of civilization." Since then, of course, numerous excavations in northwest India have undermined that. But nobody's actually said, "Well, let's examine what the trade was." In the depth, and ask the questions, not in the depth I have anyway. So yes, that's the essence of the theory.
Yeah, and also that just to briefly talk about Egypt, that we'll come to India. That, and you reckon that that basically the pharaohic dynasties that arose in Egypt, they came after these invasions, in the sense that, you know, this kind of invasion, or maybe this influence, also had something to do with the rise of Egypt as one of the dominant civilizations.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's what Flinders Petrie thought, and apparently before the pharaohs, Egypt was politically divided to lower and upper Egypt, and the new invaders gradually, over perhaps a generation or so, unified upper and lower Egypt. That's why the pharaoh's hat was in two parts, signifying upper and lower Egypt and their domination of that. And so, yes, the Phoenicians were the vectors of trade between Egypt and Phoenicia, and Buto in the Nile Delta has a lot of Phoenician evidence of their occupation. So it seems, and they were at Memphis organizing in the shortly after the invasion, they were organizing cross Red Sea crossings for turquoise and metals in the Sinai Desert. So yeah, I mean, it was the Phoenicians that bought the gold in Egypt, which in Egypt, because it was so gold rich, silver was more expensive. But by the time it got to Phoenicia and the routes en route, one of them was Ebla, one of them was Mari, which is en route to the Persian Gulf, they were 10 times more expensive. And yes, we know that Indians are prepared to pay that much more because they value it so highly. So yeah, and it all seems to make sense.
Yeah. Now let's come to India, you know, which is, you know, the really fascinating part of all of this. You have you know, commented on social media that you know, that Egypt had one river, the Mesopotamians had two, but India had like seven rivers, and one has seen tributaries and a canal system. And your suggestion is that India actually was the cradle of civilization. And of course, you know, India, Mesopotamia, Egypt, they are seen as the oldest civilizations, as far as we know, you know, urbanized civilizations, so to speak. But your suggestion is, and which a lot of new people who are doing research now also suggest, is that the cradle of civilization was actually India, and that this was a very large, geographically very large, and way more sophisticated than other civilizations at that point of time. So could you shed more light on that, given your research?
Well, yes. I mean, it was much bigger than than Sumeria or Egypt. It was it had it supported more population. Some estimates say 10% of the world's population because of these rivers fertilizing this this area. And it goes back to the end of the Ice Age. You know, the Indus-Sarasvati civilization didn't pop up out of nowhere around 3000 BC, which is the traditional date which is given. It goes back to the end of the Ice Age, because when the glaciers melted, they carved out this drainage pattern which supported so many people. And it was known, the ancient text, the Rig Veda, talks about the divine Sarasvati, and the other rivers were given associations with other gods, but it was the Sarasvati which was the main one. And of course it was a rich biodiverse area, unlike Sumeria and Egypt, and therefore it could trade. I mean, you know, it's all encapsulated in my book here, how maritime trade in the Indian subcontinent shaped the world, Ice Age to mid 8th century, because, you know, it was the center of the world at that time, in its the volume of trade. There was nothing in the Mediterranean until, there's nothing to speak of until after 3000 BC as well. Probably, not coincidentally, that was the Phoenicians kick-starting that. Nothing to speak of in Northern Europe. Probably quite a lot in East Asia, but it was in Southern Asia, and specifically with the rest of India, from Northwest India to the rest of India, and with the Persian Gulf, that it seems to have kicked off. And going right back to 10,000 BC. Indeed, in 2012, the National Institute of Oceanographic Research in India discovered two drowned ports in the Gulf of Cumbay. And it seems they haven't been able to send a mini submarine down there because it's too murky. Some rivers and winds churn it up, but they've done surveys through sonar, and these seem to show, well, I don't think they seem to show, I think they show very clearly, two ports, one which was further down the then existing river, and another one further up. And since there were two mega melts, one in 9,500 BC, or there and thereabouts, and one around 5,600 BC. That is the biblical flood, attested to all over the world, not only here. And it seems to be that the first one was existing before 9,500 BC. And this was apparently, I think it's safe to say, the famous port of Dwarka, which was then built further inland. And when the second mega melt, the flood happened, was built further inland again. And by 3000, it seems to be that Lothal was the main export port.
Yeah, and also Nick, you mentioned that you think that the Aryan invasion theory is kind of nonsensical, which a lot of historians, archaeologists, and even geneticists, so people have been working on this, have said. How did you reach that conclusion? If you could tell us briefly, why do you think that this is not a credible theory at all?
No, it's absolute nonsense. You know, they haven't discovered any Eurasian location for where they came from. The fact that they could cross great rivers in chariots, which they're supposed to have done, and invaded the most heavily densely populated area of the world at the time, is complete utter poppycock. So I kind of got that well before I started this book, actually. I hadn't then logically, by the time I started it, then advanced to the fact that it was a rich seafaring country, region. But that is attested to by a lot of references in the Rig Veda. David Frawley has pointed this out extremely well in 1991 in God, Kings and Sages, I think it's called. He was kind of ridiculed at the time, but everybody's now, I think, everybody bar a few recidivists have basically decided that he was right, and that hopefully in the book, in 2021, when the book was published, December 2021, the nails hadn't been finally knocked into the coffin of the Aryan invasion theory. So I do take it apart and use a lot of some of his books, but a lot of articles in relatively obscure historical and archaeological magazines, and weave it all together. I hope I've put the nails in the coffin if anybody wants to read it.
Yeah. And Nick, another question is that there are a lot of, these kinds of things, the fact that, you know, the numbers that we use, like from 1 to 9 and the 0, they were invented in India. There are many such, scientific innovations, not all, of course, but many of those that can be traced back to India. But somehow, these things are not that well known, across the world. Why do you think that is? I mean, it's one thing, say 100 years ago for people to call the modern numbers as Arabic numbers because the Europeans got it from the Arabs. And, at that point of time, maybe you could say that, they were not, that it was out of ignorance. But 100 years down the line, why are these things not commonly known? Do you think, and what can be done to kind of increase awareness about real history of the world? Not just about India, but across the world, including South America and Africa and other places?
I think social media has a part to play in it, but it's incredibly difficult. People, when I was researching this, and I was researching different parts but the two books are out, actually. The History of Maritime Trade. This one goes up to the mid-8th century. Then there's the Millennium Maritime Trade Revolution, 700 to 1700. And forthcoming is the Ascent of Maritime Trade, 1700 to 2025. That'll be early next year. But when I was researching a lot of this, a lot of progressive, intelligent, revisionist historians referred to an Aryan invasion, and they weren't being malevolent or colonialist or anything. It's just that they were taught that when they were at school and at university decades ago, and they haven't researched it. Their area of research is somewhat different, so they innocently repeat it, even if the arguments were shown to them that it is nonsense. But this is not alone. History is a subject which is a couple of hundred years old. And earlier mistakes were made, like British archaeologists uncovering Mesopotamian cities. Whoa, wonderful. The center of civilization, cradle of civilization. Wrong. But it takes time for this to disappear. I would suggest to you that actually, among the many mistakes made, we are further advanced in burying the Aryan invasion theory than we are on other nonsenses. Can I give you a couple of examples?
Sure, absolutely.
In 1981, a book, the until, oh, where do I go? Until the advent of archaeology, it was felt that the classical age in the Mediterranean was seamless, that the Electra and Menelaus and Odysseus and all that kind of stuff immediately melded in to the classical age. And then archaeology came up and said, no, there's a gap here. I won't go into all the tedious explanations, but so for the past century we've had we've had this idea that there was a big dark age after the Trojan War, the collapse of the Hittites, the collapse of the of Egypt into the so-called third intermediate period, that there was a 300-year dark age where nothing happened. No kings, no writing, no pottery, no maritime trade, nothing. It wasn't a dark age, it was black, nothing happened. And then suddenly it all popped up again in the 8th century, and as if by magic. This is also self-evidently poppycock. And it was addressed only in 1981. Historians had some doubts in the 70s. 1981, groundbreaking book called Centuries of Darkness happened. Was written because all this darkness was spread all across the Mediterranean, and it said this is wrong. So it was welcomed at the time, and then people wrote articles in various learned magazines and a couple more books. And again, it got lost. But it's so much more convenient to frame it in these familiar patterns. But it is nonsense. So we are still quite a long way from burying that. And it's going to take historians to come together, you know, specialists in Egypt and in the Levant, in Greece, in Spain, Sardinia, to actually come together and work out what happened. Now, I, again, in this book, I try to figure this out. The Trojan War date is supposed to be the ludicrously imprecise date of either 1188 or 1177 BC. Isaac Newton, back in the 18th century, in his little-known studies of history, thought about 900. And I reckon he's absolutely spot on. A decade either side, perhaps. And then we concertina this history down, and the Dark Age disappears, and it becomes logical. But I wouldn't bet on any time soon. It's taken, 40 years for the Aryan invasion theory to be more or less almost dead and buried. It'll probably take another 40 years for this to be accepted. I'll give you another one. Anglo-Saxons invaded England, right? Of course they didn't. They were invited in. But we still have people saying the Anglo-Saxon, the Saxon shore forts defended England against Saxons. No, they didn't. They were grain stores to ship over grain to the Roman army defending the Rhine. And actually, the English, after the Romans left, the English subdivided into their tribal units who were fighting each other, and especially the Scots and the Picts coming down from Scotland and the Irish from Ireland, and they invited these guys from Jutland and Frisia to help defend themselves. Again, explained all in my book. So we've got a lot of revisions to do from the certainties of historians of the past. So it's these. So don't feel persecuted in India about the Asian Aryan invasion theory. You're well ahead of other historical nonsense that needs revision, you know?
and I always tell people that, you know, that history should be written based on data, evidence, logic, You know, and as we go further, as we have more scientific instruments, we will uncover more truths. But what is important is to not have any prejudices and, you know, go in with an open mind rather than trying to push one idea of history or the other. And Nick, thank you so much for your work. Absolutely fascinating work, and we need more people like you to do research and you know, give the real history of the world to the people in whichever way they can. So thank you for your time today with us, Nick.
Pleasure. Thank you for the compliment. Just a concluding remark. You say evidence, and I agree with everything you say, logic and evidence and so forth, but when evidence is missing, you've got to, I think, go on the balance of probabilities.
Sure.
With something, you know. But yeah, thank you for the compliment, and thank you for the interview, Bellamy.
Thank you, Nick.